Neil Gaiman is a rock star among authors. He writes mythic fiction in which the old gods haunt American highways and back roads, children are raised by ghosts in graveyards, and things lurk behind the walls of the most ordinary homes. One of the most beloved and best-selling fantasy writers, Neil's last few books have been for children, Coraline and the Graveyard Book. Now he's come out with his first new novel for adults in nearly a decade, and it's his most personal yet, The Ocean at the End of the Lane. It's a story about being 7 years old, about how our lives are shaped and scarred by childhood experiences, and about some very magical women. And I'm so happy to be talking with him this morning. Hi, Neil.
Hello, Anne.
So this book is dedicated to your wife, rock musician Amanda Palmer, and it begins at the opening, to Amanda, who wanted to know. What did she want to know?
I think she wanted to know what it was like to be me when I was a kid. And it's sort of strange because the starting point was actually inspired by a real-life event that I heard about when I was in my 40s. But it's still very much trying to paint a portrait of what it was like to be me, age 7.
Well, by the time we get to the end of the book, knowing has taken on kind of cosmic, mythic proportions. But at the beginning, it starts really simply. There's a man, the narrator, has gone home for a family funeral. And while he's there, he drives down a country lane near his old home, and he remembers a little girl he used to play with, and then on a whim, he just stops at the farm where she used to live. What happens next?
He meets her mother, he believes, and he goes and sits by a duck pond, and he remembers Letty Hempstock, this girl who was 11 when he was 7, used to call the duck pond the ocean. And remembering that, he remembers everything. And these strange, weird, dangerous things that he'd forgotten all come flooding back very slowly, and we get to watch as they come flooding back. And it begins with the family's lodger stealing the car and committing suicide, the family car committing suicide in it. And his suicide has some rather strange ripples into the world.
Is that the real-life event you said you remembered?
That was the real-life event, yes. I was. It was 2003, and I had a Mini, new Mini Cooper, and I talked to my dad about how nice it was to have a Mini Cooper. And I said, we used to have one of those. Whatever happened to that? Why did you get rid of it? It was such a great little car. And he said, have I never told you that story? And I said, no, you never have. And he told me about a lodger who came over from South Africa and who had smuggled a bunch of money belonging to his friends out of South Africa too. Because at that time, you could only export a very small amount of money at a time from South Africa. And how the guy went to the casino, gambled away all of his money, and then only intended to dip into his friend's money until he'd made back what he'd lost, and he lost everything. And he came back in the small hours of the morning and stole our car, drove it to the end of the lane, and killed himself. Hearing this story was so strange. I'm going, well, I was 7. I never knew any of that happened. And he said, well, of course you didn't. And I thought, what a strange story. It was so strange, the idea that this thing happened so close to us in my car, and I'd never known. And
did you keep
it? It haunted me.
Did your parents keep that car? Did you drive it?
No, they sold it that afternoon. My dad said, he said, I knew your mother was never going to get into it again, and it was sold by the afternoon.
But there's sort of the you know, one of the questions at the heart of the book is thinking back on memory, thinking about how memory works, how it is that you can not remember something that you were part of.
It's funny because I've written several books over the years, mostly as comics up till now, which were about childhood and memory and the ways that our memories can play us false and the ways that our memories are dangerous things. And sometimes remembering can take you into pretty dark and dangerous places. I did my very first book, Violent Cases, was about that. And then a decade later, I wrote a book called Mr. Punch. And again, they were graphic novels. I think, I feel like The Ocean at the End of the Lane in many ways is stylistically part of that. It's like, it's all about childhood. It's all about memory. It's all about both how dangerous memory is and what we gain and what we give up with memory.
Well, you've written a number of children's books also in which there's always this sense that there's something dark and dangerous lurking behind the walls. You know, there are wolves behind the walls, or there's Coraline's whole creepy world behind the walls. It sounds like you're very aware that there is this kind of shadow behind our rational mind, things that we sort of remember but don't quite remember. That is the world behind the wall, isn't it?
When I'd finished writing The Ocean at the End of the Lane, I was looking at an interview that Art Spiegelman did with Morris Sendak in The New Yorker, and it was done as a two-page comic, which they both drew. There was a line that Morris Sendak said. He said, "I remember my own childhood vividly. I knew terrible things, but I knew I mustn't let adults know I knew. It would scare them." And I thought that is the epigraph for my book, because I remember feeling like that. I remember what it was like to be a kid and to feel like you had secret knowledge, to look at these adults wandering around, blundering through the world, big and dangerous and off on their own things, but you knew the world was more dangerous than they did.
Like what? Do you remember? I mean, does a particular scene or something, memory from childhood, pop into your mind if you think of knowing something that the adults didn't?
No. I mean, I could sort of build up things for you. But out of context, they're almost dreamlike. I remember wandering with a gang of local school kids who I just ran into on my way home from school. We trespassed onto a old, these gardens that went on forever, belonging to a huge, weird old manor house that had been completely abandoned. And at the very, very far end of this thing, we found a tiny little playhouse built for children, this one-room playhouse with stained glass windows. And on the door, hanging from the door as a knocker, was this red-painted imp demon creature just staring out. And as kids, we just wouldn't go in. We knew it was a terrible place. We knew it was bad. And trying to dare each other to go in, and none of us would. Something like that, where it's almost hard to explain now as an adult why it was so scary, why it was so strange, but you know that it was.
I've always been struck by the way some people have very vivid memories, not just of their childhood, not just of the events that happened, but of what it felt like to be a child, to know things in that way. And then other people don't. I mean, I don't, for instance, but my sister does. Do you?
I think I do. More to the point, what I really remember as a kid was reading books by people who got it wrong. I would read books that were children's books with kids in them, and I'd read them and go, how could somebody not remember what it was to be a kid? And promising myself, swearing to myself, that if ever I grew up and became a writer, I wouldn't forget.
Oh, that reminds me of, there's this wonderful passage. I should ask you to read it. Did you bring your book with you?
I do. I have it in front of me.
Do you remember that passage? Here, wait, let me see. Oh, I know. There's a wonderful section where your character, by now he's the little boy, he's 7 years old, and he's reading outside this book of Egyptian myths, and he's thinking about the books that he likes and the difference between what children read and what adults read. Do you know that section?
Let me see if I can find it. It was a warm spring day and sunny, and I climbed up a rope ladder to the lowest branch of the big beech tree, sat on it, and read my book. I was not scared of anything when I read my book. I was far away in ancient Egypt, learning about Hathor and how she had stalked Egypt in the form of a lioness, and she had killed so many people that the sands of Egypt turned red. and how they had only defeated her by mixing beer and honey and sleeping draughts and dyeing this concoction red, so she thought it was blood, and she drank it and fell asleep. Ra, the father of the gods, made her the goddess of love after that, so the wounds she had inflicted on people would now only be wounds of the heart. I wonder why the gods had done that. Why hadn't they just killed her when they had the chance? I liked myths. They weren't adult stories, and they weren't children's stories. They were better than that. They just were. Adult stories never made sense, and they were so slow to start. They made me feel like there were secrets, Masonic, mythic secrets to adulthood. Why didn't adults want to read about Narnia, about secret islands, and smugglers, and dangerous fairies?
I love that passage, clearly written by someone who never grew out of reading about Narnia, secret islands, smugglers, and dangerous fairies.
Actually, I think most adults have a kid inside, and the adults who liked Narnia and secret islands as kids love things like that now. I think the huge success of things like Harry Potter, the enormous success of fantasy and more adventurous fantasy as a genre over the last decade, I think, shows that you never grow out of a love for that stuff.
We're talking with best-selling fantasy writer Neil Gaiman about his brand new novel, The Ocean at the End of the Lane. I'm Anne Strainchamps, and you're listening to 45 North on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Later this hour, if you're inspired to curl up with a good book, we've got just the beverage to go with it. Cocktails inspired by literary classics. So if you feel like making a tequila mockingbird or a Moby drink, stay with us. Right now, we're talking about myth and magic with novelist Neil Gaiman. His new book is called The Ocean at the End of the Lane. And Neil, we should talk about the three women at the heart of this story, the Hempstock women, who may live in a farmhouse, but turn out to be very, very far from ordinary farm women. Tell us about them.
The Hempstocks, I suppose, began for me when I was a little kid. I was 8 or 9, and I'd heard that a farm down our lane was mentioned in the Doomsday Book back in about, you know, the 11th century. So knowing that, I started, being a kid, imagining that probably the farm was the same farm that I knew. I couldn't imagine that it looked any different from 1,000 years earlier. And I loved the idea that the same people had lived there for 1,000 years. So in my head, going through my teenage years, I always had this lovely little sort of weird idea of a farmhouse down the end of my lane in which the people around the farm had just been there for a good 1,000 years, maybe longer. And I'm not even sure. By the time I was about 15 or 16, they were called Hempstocks. And when I came to write other books, every now and then I would slide the Hempstocks in. There's a few Hempstocks in Stardust. The Graveyard Book has Liza Hempstock in. And I just love the idea that one day I'd get to do a story that was actually set in the lane that I grew up in. And then we'd actually meet the Hempstocks. And they were much more of a kind of a triple goddess than I'd been planning. They're like an aspect of the Fates.
I was going to ask you, are they the Fates? Are they the triple goddess, maiden, mother, crone? And did you feel like you wrote them or invoked them?
I think they're all of those things. Young Letty Hempstock, who looks 11, but has been 11 for a very long time now, says that her duck pond is the ocean. And she came from the old country across that ocean. And her mother says that Letty can't remember the really old country, of course, because that sank. And then old Mrs. Hempstock, who may or may not be able to remember the Big Bang, says that they're both wrong, and actually the really old country blew up.
So they have such a feeling of old British folktales to them, but that goddess aspect, actually, I was wondering whether there's any piece of your wife in there, because, you know, you're married to Amanda Palmer. She's a rock star, and rock stars are goddesses, right? That's what they do.
It's true. It actually is. It's kind of wonderful sometimes being in an audience and looking up and going, oh, my God, there's 3,000 people in this room and they're worshipping my wife. I'm sure there's a lot of Amanda, particularly in Letty. But I think really the whole thing was for Amanda. She likes feelings. She likes honesty. And she's not very good at fantasy. She kind of likes fantasy, but she likes it to be really rooted in reality. So the magic isn't the engine that drives this, even though there's strange, glorious, magical things that happen. It's the reality is the engine that drives it.
Mm. Speaking of magic, once the real magic starts to happen in this book, what I love is it's all about words. Is that there's another passage I wanted to ask if you'd read for us. It's the part when Letty starts to sing for the first time.
Of course. The girl holding my hand said, "If you ain't telling me your name, I'll bind you as a nameless thing, and you'll still be bound and tied and sealed like a polter or a shuck." She waited, but the thing said nothing. And Letty Hempstock began to say words in a language I did not know. Sometimes she was talking, and sometimes it was more like singing, in a tongue that was nothing I had ever heard. I knew the tune, though. It was a child's song, the tune to which we sang the nursery rhyme, "Girls and Boys Come Out to Play." That was the tune, but her words were older words. I was certain of that. And as she sang, things happened beneath the orange sky. The earth writhed and churned with worms, long grey worms that pushed up from the ground beneath our feet. Something came hurtling at us from the centre mass of flapping canvas. It was a little bigger than a football. At school, during games, mostly I'd dropped things I was meant to catch, or closed my hand on them a moment too late, letting them hit me in the face or the stomach. But this thing was coming straight at me and Letty Hempstock, and I did not think. I only did. I put both my hands out, and I caught the thing, a flapping, writhing mass of cobwebs and rotting cloth. And as I caught it in my hands, I felt something hurt me, a stabbing pain in the sole of my foot, momentary and then gone, as if I had trodden upon a pin. Letty knocked the thing I was holding out of my hands, and it fell to the ground where it collapsed into itself. And through all this, she continued to sing. I have dreamed of that song, of the strange words to that simple rhyme song, and on several occasions I have understood what she was saying in my dreams. In those dreams, I spoke that language too, the first language, and I had dominion over the nature of all that was real. In my dream, it was the tongue of what is, and anything spoken in it becomes real because nothing said in that language can be a lie. It is the most basic building brick of everything. In my dreams, I have used that language to heal the sick and to fly. Once I dreamed I kept a perfect little bed and breakfast by the seaside, and to everyone who came to stay with me, I would say, in that tongue, "Be whole." And they would become whole, not be broken people, not any longer, because I had spoken the language of shaping.
That is such a beautiful passage. And, you know, I feel like this is an old, old idea, this idea that there was an earlier, original language in which words made the world. What were you thinking about when you wrote this?
I was definitely thinking, well, it goes back, of course, for me, to the Bible, the idea that God made the world by speaking it. In the beginning was the Word, and it's a lovely idea, you know. You say, "Let there be light," and by saying it, using the right words, you have power over it. And of course, the other lovely idea that I remember learning and being both delighted and baffled by as a little kid being taught my bar mitzvah lessons was the idea that the name of God had power. If you knew God's real name, you could invoke God and do magical things with that name, which, again, sort of stuck.
Well, that's so true in so many folk tales, too, isn't it? You know, you never let somebody know your real name.
Absolutely not. And it was one of the fun and interesting games that I got to play when I was writing this book. Who gets named and who doesn't?
Well, yeah, because the narrator never has a name, right?
No, none of his family do.
Right. Well, it's also fun in reading that passage to think of all the other books and writers in this long tradition who you may be nodding your head at through this passage. I mean, what came to my mind was Ursula Le Guin's lovely Wizard of Earthsea novels.
Absolutely. I remember reading Wizard of Earthsea. I must have been maybe 11, maybe 12. And again, the idea, the language of dragons, the language of magic is the thing in which you cannot lie, is the thing that things that are said are true because it is a language that is truth and is a language of shaping. Absolutely. One of those things that's in my head.
Neil, is there a passage you'd choose to read to us at the end?
Let me do a little bit of Granny, because she's a bit with a coin.
Oh, I love that bit. That's another one I marked. Yeah. And I was going to ask you, actually, while you're finding it, are there other myths that you especially love that you are taken by that you haven't taken into fiction yet?
Yes, there are a few. Although, also, some of the myths that I love, I just keep coming back to. The Norse gods just drag me back again and again. And whenever I think I'm done with them, I wind up reading or rereading the prose Edda or the poetic Edda and thinking, you know, there's so much more I could do with them. So definitely, I'd love to do something with them. At some point, I keep thinking one of the oddest myth places that we don't do anything with, really, very much is early Christian myth.
What kind of early Christian myth? I mean, like,
well, for
Adam
example,
and Eve, or?
No. I was thinking more of there's a layer of sort of mythy stuff that grew up fairly early on. There was a gospel, one of the lost gospels, called the Gospel of the Infancy of Christ by Thomas, in which we get to learn what young Jesus was like. And it's very mythic. It's not biblical Jesus at all, because young Jesus would do things like make clay statues of birds and bring them to life. And when a teacher would try to chastise him, the teacher would be struck down. And anybody who irritated boy Jesus would be either killed or turned blind. And pretty soon there's a point where you get Joseph turning to Mary and saying, look, if he's going to keep killing people like this, we're going to have to keep him in the house. Which I look at and I go, you know, there's something so strange, the idea that people were telling each other these stories. There was a craving for sort of like Superman and Superboy stories. They wanted the adventures of Jesus Christ when he was a boy. And they would tell each other these wonderful, weird, non-biblical stories. So
yeah,
I wonder
if they connect to other stories of young boy gods. I mean, doesn't...
Absolutely. That's why they feel so lovely and mythy. And there's also the other one that I promised myself that I will go and do something with one day, and I really haven't, is the Egyptian gods. They crept a little bit into Sandman at the edges, but the world of the Egyptian gods, these glorious animal-headed creatures, I would love to do more with them. And, of course, I did put them in American Gods. Actually, I've written them quite a lot, haven't I?
Well, there's that little reference to them in this one, too. But what do you like about the feeling of those Egyptian gods?
I think it's hot, there's sand there, and they're slightly incomprehensible. They feel a little bit more like aliens. You know, the Greek gods feel like us. You read stories about what the Greek gods did, and you go, okay, I get this. This is us. You read a good Egyptian god story, and you go, maybe they came down from space. Why are they behaving like this? What is going on? It's just a little bit. It's odder. It's stranger. I don't know. I would love to go and play in that sandpit.
And what do the Norse myths feel like to you?
Oh, very cold. well, also, the glory of the Norse myths is it's one of the very few mythic structures that has its own sort of doomsday built in which everybody dies. You know, in solid sort of eschatological Christian tradition, you get the final days and you have the predictions, but the good guys win in that. The wonderful thing about the Norse is it just goes bad. And then they all get to fight the final battles and they get to die in horrible ways and night falls, and then maybe, if we're lucky, it all starts again.
Yeah, but it's not, you're not left with the uncomfortable decision whether you should believe them or not, and believe that they're still alive or not, because no, they're not.
This is true, which is a weird, lovely, wonderful thing to have to hold in your head. And it's one of the things that actually I think is almost like an engine for me that drives my fascination with the Norse gods, which is you're going, okay, so is Ragnarok a thing that is going to happen, or is it a thing that has already happened, and is it an engine that is still going? And obviously, if you are worshipping Thor and Odin and these people, you are assuming that they're there now, and Ragnarok is still a thing in the future, which is kind of fun.
So you were going to read us another passage about Granny.
I will. I said I promise, said Letty Hempstock. I won't let you be hurt. Hurt? Said a high, cracked voice. Who's hurt? What's been hurt? Why would anybody be hurt? It was old Mrs. Hempstock, her apron held between her hands, and in the hollow of the apron so many daffodils that the light reflected up from them transformed her face to gold, and the kitchen seemed bathed in yellow light. Letty said, Something's causing trouble. It's giving people money, in their dreams and in real life. She showed the old lady my shilling. My friend found himself choking on this shilling when he woke up this morning. Old Mrs. Hempstock put her apron on the kitchen table, rapidly moved the daffodils off the cloth and onto the wood. Then she took the shilling from Letty. She squinted at it, sniffed it, rubbed at it, listened to it, or put it to her ear, at any rate, then touched it with the tip of her purple tongue. It's new, she said at last. It says 1912 on it, but it didn't exist yesterday. Letty said, I knew there was something funny about it. I looked up at old Mrs. Hempstock. How do you know? Good question, lovey. It's electron decay, mostly. You have to look at things closely to see the electrons. They're the little dinky ones that look like tiny smiles. The neutrons are the grey ones that look like frowns. The electrons were all a bit too smiley for 1912, so then I checked the sides of the letters in the old king's head, and everything was a tad too crisp and sharp. You must have very good eyesight, I told her. She gave me back the coin. Not as good as once it was, but then when you get to be my age, your eyesight won't be as sharp as it once was neither. And she let out a guffaw, as if she'd said something very funny. How old is that? Letty looked at me, and I was worried that I'd said something rude. Sometimes adults didn't like to be asked their ages, and sometimes they did. In my experience, old people did. Old Mrs. Hempstock went over to a cupboard and took out several colourful vases. Old enough, she said. I remember when the moon was made. Hasn't there always been a moon? Bless you. Not in the slightest. I remember the day the moon came. We looked up in the sky. It was all dirty brown and sooty grey here, then not green and blue. She half-filled each of the vases at the sink. Then she took a pair of blackened kitchen scissors and snipped off the bottom half-inch of stem from each of the daffodils.
I love old Mrs. Hempstock. And I love it that you made one of the most powerful people in the book, maybe the most powerful person in the book, an old woman.
I think, for me, I wanted to try and put what I suppose I best describe as grandmotherly energy into the book. I remember both of my grandmothers very, very well. And they both, in very different ways, had their kitchens as their domain. One of them was very sharp-tongued and opinionated and tart, but absolutely loving. And the other was just huge and gentle and very, very loving. And grandmotherly places were the best places to be when I was a little kid. And I wanted to try and take that feeling of welcome, that feeling of food as love, and that feeling of sort of sharp-eyed practicality, and give all that to the Hempstocks. So if that came from anywhere, it probably comes from my grandmothers.
Well, the world would be a better place if we had more grandmothers, and if they also ran the world, as Mrs. Hempstock does. Neil, thanks so much for talking.
Oh, thank you, Anne.
Neil Gaiman is the best-selling author of American Gods, Coraline, The Graveyard Book, and The Sandman series of graphic novels. He's just come out with his first adult novel in nearly a decade. It's called The Ocean at the End of the Lane. By the way, if you ever want more information about this show, something you've heard, or if you would like to download the podcasts of previous shows, including this one, you'll find it all on our webpage. That is wpr.org/45north. Or if you prefer Facebook, we also post show news and announcements on the Facebook page. It's a nice place to comment and keep up with what's going on here. Our Facebook page is 45 North on WPR, and I look forward to chatting with you there. I'm Ann Strangehamps, and you're listening to 45 North on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I have the perfect book for your next literary weekend. It's called Tequila Mockingbird, and that's tequila as in Cuervo Gold, Cocktails with a Literary Twist. Tim Federle's the author, and Tim, there has to be a backstory to this book. You're either a big reader or a really serious drink slinger, or both.
That's right. It's so nice to be here, Anne. There is a bit of a backstory. I was touring last year with a novel that I wrote for middle schoolers, actually, called Better Nate Than Ever. I can't get away from puns. And I would visit with all these booksellers and bookstores and librarians, and person after person, unprompted, told me about how they have all these customers come in looking for Tequila Mockingbird, not quite realizing, of course, that the poor Harper Lee, who's still living God lover, wrote To Kill a Mockingbird, of course. And so borrowing from the idea that the customer is never wrong, I thought, you know, we should deliver this book to these people. They want this book. So I set out to create really a tribute to classic books that you either struggled to get through during college or loved so much that you might want to raise a glass to toast them.
So what's in the drink, the title drink? What's in a Tequila Mockingbird?
You've got 1.5 ounces of tequila, 2 drops of hot sauce, and 1 dill pickle standing by. You pour the tequila into a shot glass, you add the hot sauce, you slam it back, and then you take a bite of the dill pickle with the after note, no tears allowed here. If you can't stand the heat, get out of the South. So that's the that's one of the sillier kind of shots that I built. But some of the drinks, many of the drinks are sweeter and go down a little easier.
And the dill pickle refers to one of the characters in To Kill a Mockingbird. That's like a food pun.
It is a food pun. It's a pun heavy book. The deviled egg wears Prada is one of the food recipes. There are a bunch of bar bites in the back of the book for simple parties. You know, my real dream in writing the book was my mom belongs to this book club, and she said, "Oh, I love the book club, but sometimes I feel so guilty because by the time I get there, I haven't read the whole thing." So I thought it would be really fun to create something that might go hand in hand, or, you know, icing glass with a book club. So there's a whole section on party punches as well.
Yeah, and I was also thinking by the time you've knocked back a few Ryan prejudices or remembrance of things, perhaps nobody's going to know whether you've read the book or not.
Exactly. Yeah, that's exactly right. You can just get away with, you know, would you like another round?
Well, I was an English major, and I have to say, I'm not sure that Moby Dick or Wuthering Heights would have struck me as inspiration for a cocktail. They're not always the most festive of reads.
No, that's it's a good point, Anne. In re-exploring these books, I was really struck, particularly, the work of Ernest Hemingway. These are not the types of books that you re-explore and go, yeah, this is really going to go great with a hammock. But that's actually part of the fun. I wanted to, create something that might help some of the harder books go down a little bit easier.
Yeah, it looks like Hemingway inspired a number of drinks. What have you got here? A Farewell to Amaretto? The Old Man and the Seagrams?
Yeah, that's one of my favorite ones. What I discovered is what felt like about half of all literary classics take place at the high seas. There's just so many angry old fishermen. There's Moby Dick, which is Moby Drink in my book, The Old Man and the Sea, Old Man and the Seagrams. The Rime of the Ancient Mariner inspired The Lime of the Ancient Mariner. and there really was this classic thing back in the day. If you really wanted to make a good living, you would write about really vengeful fishermen.
Well, those old fishermen, if they drank anything, you figured they just had a, big bottle of Jim Beam or something like that. Maybe they would have been happier if they drank cocktails.
You never know. I find that cocktails tend to bring out the more colorful side of everybody. Though, of course, I always say, don't sail and sip. sip and sail, really.
I confess, Moby Dick is one of those books that I gave up on. I could not get through all the instructions for proper whale harpooning. What's in your Moby Drink?
Moby Drink is vodka and then blue curacao, which is a very bright blue liqueur that has sort of an orange taste. And you put an ounce of vodka, you put half an ounce of blue curacao, and then you open up a lemon lime soda, you fill it to the top. And the gimmick with Moby Drink is that as a garnish, you take a Swedish fish and you spear it with one of those little cocktail swords. And then you get to play Captain Ahab and play party host all at once.
Have you served any of these to friends?
I have. Well, the joke was, I grew up in this household where my parents just happened to not be very big drinkers. And so I didn't grow up in a huge cocktail society until I moved to New York City.
You wound up on Broadway. That's got to be a cocktail-heavy kind of life.
It is. That's exactly right. I moved to New York to dance on Broadway, and I was lucky enough to dance in a bunch of shows. And when you're in New York, you're constantly, especially if you're in show business, you're either drinking cocktails at opening night or you're drinking cocktails when the show closes early.
So what generally came first for you, the title of the drink or the recipe?
it's like asking a composer lyricist. It's like, okay, Simon and Garfunkel, who wrote the lyrics? For many of the drinks, the pun was sort of built right in. For something like Frankenstein, I looked at it and I created Drankenstein. And from Drankenstein, I looked at it and I thought, what could I do with this? And so I created this bright green Halloween-ready cocktail. And then for Bloody Carrie, which is a Bloody Mary that's in tribute to Stephen King's classic Carrie, I sort of came up with the title, and then I took a standard Bloody Mary recipe and I added wasabi paste, so it had a real kick to it.
A real bite.
Because those girls in that book, they were tough, so I wanted that drink to have a real kick. So most of the time I stuck with the 70 titles that really spoke to me, including newer classics like Bridget Jones's Daiquiri, Are You There, God, It's Me, Margarita.
So I have to ask you about a few of them. Like one of my favorites is The Turn of the Screwdriver. It's a reference to Henry James, The Turn of the Screw. Mm-hmm. And a screwdriver is a classic drink, right?
Yeah. And one of the things I did in sort of choosing the drinks is some of them are a little trickier and some of them require a few ingredients, but I thought it would be the most fun because we're in this moment in society when there are so many cocktail books out now and there's so many things to choose from for parties. And I thought it would be fun, rather than making my readers sweat and have to, you know, drive across town to pick up 1,000 ingredients, I thought it would be cool just to do little twists on classics. So for Turn of the Screwdriver, which is sort of a classic ghost story, really, I said, you know, a true classic holds up to different interpretations. And so I offer two different recipes, one that's just vodka and orange juice and one that's vanilla vodka with a sparkling orange soda like Orangina, which is just a slightly different twist on the classic.
And this really works with the book because isn't the book about, I'm trying to remember, isn't it about there's a governess and
there's a governess.
And she seems to be seeing things, and either she's really seeing things or she's crazy.
That's exactly right. The trouble for this poor gal is that nobody else seems to be seeing these tricky apparitions. And so she, you know, more than a century after publication, the book was published in 1898 by Henry James, like you said. Even a century later, literary scholars are kind of still scratching their heads if Henry James intended the audience to think that the governess was a lunatic, or was this a real haunted house? And so that inspired my idea to do two different variations on a screwdriver, much the same way the turn of the screw can be interpreted many different ways.
Now, there's some books I can't believe you didn't come up with cocktails for. For instance, there's no...
You'll have to tell me. Oh, my gosh, Anne, I don't want to let you down.
There's no cocktail for The Great Gatsby. I mean, if anybody could have inspired a cocktail, surely it would be Jay Gatsby. You get the feeling he drank one every night.
I know,
or many.
You're not wrong. You aren't wrong. And in fact, when the movie came out, I created a Great Gatsby cocktail for, I think, the San Francisco Chronicle.
What is it?
And gosh, you're putting me on the spot, and I have to remember what that was. I'm going to have to pull that one up.
Right, Jim, you're going to have to email us that so we can make it.
I will. I have to say, after creating like over 70 drinks, occasionally I get a little bit cross-eyed, and I have to go, which one was that? I just remember that it was, I think champagne was involved, because anything that Mr. Gatsby would have approved of had to have been pretty highfalutin.
Okay, so then the other one, because you've got a number of classic children's titles, there's no Harry Potter drink. I can't believe you didn't want to try your own recipe for butterbeer.
I know, Anne. They're serving butterbeer down in Orlando at that big theme park.
Oh,
well,
they are?
So this was the idea. Yeah, before your listeners gasp and say, how dare he turn children's classics into a cocktail, I will say there's a section called Refreshments for Recovering Readers, which was inspired by Hemingway's quote, always do sober what you said you'd do drunk. That will teach you to keep your mouth shut. So there's Charlie and the Chocolate Fake Teeny. There's Pear the Wild Things Are, Rip Van Drinkle. So there are a number of children's classics that I turned into non-alcoholic hangover cures.
Well, basically. some of them sound terrific, and some of them, frankly, sound perfectly dreadful. Like, I'm looking back here. The Phantom Toll Juice. I think it's got...
Yeah.
God, what does that have in it? Something horrible.
Yeah. No, the Phantom Toll Juice was inspired by this bug juice that's served at camps. That's really kind of a very bizarre concoction of powders. So the Phantom Toll Juice has Kool-Aid and sugar and club soda. And then you actually freeze the Kool-Aid in ice cube trays and you drop it in the club soda. And as the Kool-Aid melts, the drink actually changes color. So this is a family-friendly recipe. And then
White Tang also, which sounds awful. I'm looking at
it. Yeah, doesn't that sound just ridiculous?
3 ounces of milk and 2 tablespoons of Tang powder.
I know. Would you believe it's actually delicious? Because what you do is you add 5 ounces of water and a handful of ice, and you blend it. And then it's like a really delicious, it's almost like an orange Julius. Believe it or not, I've never had somebody turn it away once they've taken a sip. And of course, that one is in tribute to White Fang, 1906 by Jack London.
Okay, well, before I let you go, you've got to give us one more recipe so we can all try it out this weekend.
Ooh, one more recipe. I'm going to give you a recipe very quickly for something called Paradise Sauced, which is, of course, based on Milton's classic poem Paradise Lost. This is an
which you would need a drink to get through.
Oh my gosh, it's so epic. You would need more than a drink. You'd need a bar. But luckily, we're going to create a drink. So you're going to rim a cocktail glass in sugar, which is very simple to do. You just slice a lime, you twist it around the rim of your glass, and then you upheave it onto a plate of sugar. And then it's 1.5 ounces of vodka, 1 ounce of sour apple schnapps.
Oh, the apple.
Yeah, oh yes, Garden of Eden. We have to get to the core of the issue, as they say. 1/2 ounce of lime juice and then 1/2 teaspoon of granulated sugar. And you're going to shake all those ingredients and you're going to pour it into your cocktail glass. And you're going to, you know, you're going to sip away to some of the classic poems and novels that make up our great canon of literature, some of which actually are just easier to get through with a good drink.
Tim, thanks so much for talking today and for the inspiration.
Thank you so much, Anne.
Tim Federle is the author of the children's novel Better Nate Than Ever, and we've been talking about his new book of recipes, Tequila Mockingbird, Cocktails with a Literary Twist. And in case you want to try one or two of Tim's recipes this weekend, we'll post a few of them on our Facebook page, including that Grapefruit Gatsby Punch. Our Facebook page is 45 North on WPR. Before we go, I want to invite you to join us in person next week at 10 o'clock. We'll be hosting our first ever Sound Salon with record producer and performing artist Henry Sapoznik. Henry is the musician credited with starting the Klezmer Music Revival, and he also directs the Mehrend Institute for Yiddish Culture at the UW-Madison. And, well, I'll let him explain what we'll be doing next week. Henry, what is a Sound Salon?
Sound Salon is a kind of an interesting mix of both historic recordings and the backstory of these amazing recordings that were made in America for the last century and more. And then how that music still speaks to us today. We listen to the old stuff, and then we hear like new music that is based on these recordings to really show that this is not just something that, you know, would interest our great-grandparents, but is something for us today, too.
So it's a conversation between the past and the present, but what kind of recordings, what kind of music are we talking about?
Why limit yourself? There were so many hundreds of thousands of great 78 records made at, in a lot of cases, at the moment the music was being created, jazz, ethnic, hillbilly, pop music. There is so much terrific stuff that most of it has not been heard since the days that it was recorded. So we've got like this audio message in a bottle from our predecessors to say, hey, look at this great stuff we did. It's yours too.
This is music that's 78s that have been sitting around in, I don't know, archives or boxes or something?
Just like a whole bunch of them right here in Madison at the Mills Music Library. They've been sitting there orphaned since Calvin Coolidge was in office. And we're getting to liberate them and listen to them again and like listen to that terrific, reassuring sizzle and pop. It's amazing that when you listen to this stuff again, there's something even the people who it was made for would not have gotten. So this is great. We get a second chance to listen to American music on its best.
So this is our first Sound Salon is coming up next week. And what kind of recordings are you going to bring us for this first one?
I think for the first one, we're going to doing a programming. The Mehrend Institute has our annual one-day free event, Abyssala Klezkamp. And it's a whole day of Yiddish culture, music, dance, poetry, media. And I thought what we would do is we would listen to the music of the period that inspired this event. We're going to listen to like some of the thousands of Jewish records that were made both here and in Europe that are here at the Mills Library. So we're going to be hearing some of the greatest of the greats.
Klezmer music?
It's klezmer music. It's cantorial music. It's Yiddish theater. I've got some songs that I learned from Scratchy 78s that I have sort of reconfigured with new English translations, or I should say new English translations. That's my ethnic moment.
And are you going to play for us yourself? You're a famous musician.
Yes, I'm going to bring along my tenor guitar or my banjo or both. Stand back. He's got a banjo. So it's kind of everything. And I'll be hanging out with you, which is totally cool because you're going to ask me all sorts of fun and unusual, and I never would have thought of that kind of question.
I'll do my best. Our first broadcast sound salon will be open to the public. So if you are in Madison next week, stop by the studio. We would love to see you. For directions and information, go to our webpage. It's wpr.org/45north. It's always a pleasure spending Fridays with you. I hope you have a great weekend, and we'll talk again next Friday. I'm Ann Strange-Sampson. This is 45 North on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.